next on Unsolved Mysteries. A man on the run ends up dead in a deserted parking lot in Tennessee. Who was he running from and why? Legend has it that a fortune in gold bars was hidden deep inside a New Mexico mine. Was the treasure removed in a secret government operation? He seems like a charismatic ladies' man. In reality, he's a brutal serial killer who murdered 5 women. And a drug lord awaiting trial is hospitalized. And then he pulls off a daring escape dressed as his own sister. 5 stories. They're all strange, but guess what? They're all true. I'm Dennis Farina, and this is Unsolved Mysteries. Baja California Peninsula, 300 miles south of San Diego. A young American, disoriented, penniless, and obviously out of place, wandered into the Mexican village of Colonia Vicente Guerrero. He lingered for months, living on handouts, depending on the charity of strangers. For one California couple, tales of the young stranger were a ray of hope in the search for their 34-year-old son. Gordon Collins had been missing for months.
I know he's alive. I can't get on with my business. I can't get on with nothing until, we get him home.
Gordon was vacationing with his girlfriend, Anastasia Seals, and another couple near Santa Rosalia, a popular deep-sea fishing port near the middle of the Baja Peninsula. 4 days after they arrived, the group secured a boat at a local hotel. Gordon's friend, Wayne Schwartz, had fished off the Baja coast many times. As the group left port, a fisherman on his way in warned them a storm was brewing. Several hours later, a fierce storm would indeed hit the area. Gordon Collins and his friends never returned. The next day, a hotel employee was sent out to look for them. His search ended 28 miles northeast. Gordon's girlfriend, Anastasia Seals, and Wayne Schwartz were dead. But Gordon and Wayne's wife, Arlene Burlington, were nowhere to be found.
The bodies and all the paraphernalia out of the boat was all within 1 square mile of each other. Because I talked to the fellow that fished the bodies out. And we say, hey, where's the other 2 jackets? Where's the other 2 people?
For 3 days, the United States Coast Guard searched a 250-mile area. Nothing. It seemed obvious that Gordon and Arlene had also perished.
In time, Gordon and Arlene's parents were asked to sign death certificates. However, reports that Gordon was still alive had already begun to filter across the border. Some thought that he might be suffering from amnesia. His parents went south to Mexico to find out.
We got flyers made up, and 2 Mexican fishermen come running up to us and kept pointing to the flyer. He said they seen a guy come out of the water. He just had shorts, and he was all cut up, waiting there, trying to get on a bus station. I was very excited. Things started fitting together because this is where the accident happened. They found the bodies just a mile and a half off of this shore. It's got to be Gordy.
Around the same time, Gordon was also spotted on a nearby beach by a man named Jose Peralta.
You have your blanket?
Okay.
You have your blanket? I'm cold.
Jose said that Gordy said he was waiting for friends he went fishing with. And could he have Jose's blanket because he was going to sleep on the beach there at Cabo and wait for his friends.
Okay.
On one trip, we're headed toward La Paz, and we stopped at a few of these taco places. And they says, yeah, I seen him an hour ago. So we went on down for probably another 3 or 4 miles, and we stopped again. And the guy says, yeah, we seen him about 30 minutes ago. So we finally got right into town, and they says, yeah, within 5 minutes. And then they seen us together, and I don't know what happened, but everybody just clammed up. We couldn't get no more information.
Over the next 3 months, Gordon Collins was spotted at least 50 times in 7 different locations, all in the area of La Paz and Cabo San Lucas at the southern end of the Baja Peninsula. Gordon's parents hired Bill Garcia, a private investigator who alerted newspapers in Baja. After the articles ran, Garcia received several calls from a village 300 miles south of Tijuana.
He was 4 or 5 months here in town. He never worked here, never worked. And he only hang around here in town. He was walking all the time. And almost in the town, everybody knows him.
We've shown them pictures and everyone recognizes him. And they're positive that it's him. The people that have talked to him know some things about Gordon and feel confident that he is there.
The man identified as Gordon was eventually arrested for stealing food. A local sheriff brought in James Hatfield, an American living in the village, to translate.
My name's James. What's yours?
Hi, I'm Gordy.
There's no doubt in my mind it's Gordon, because when we met him in jail, I introduced myself to him and he gave me his name, Gordy. And then when the flyer came out, it's right there on the flyer, Gordon, and you can't get the two pictures mixed up. It's the same.
He moved on shortly before we were able to get to that area, and we haven't been able to find where he's gone from there.
Over the next year, sporadic sightings of Gordon continued. The U.S. consulate has officially reversed its position and no longer presumes that Gordon Collins is dead.
You just can't up and give up because it's your son. I know it keeps me driving and keeps me going, and I want to get him home.
Gordon Collins is 6'2" tall and has light hair and blue eyes. Based on eyewitness descriptions, a police artist made this sketch of the man thought to be Gordon Collins. If you have any information that might help find him, please log on to our website at unsolved.com. Knoxville, Tennessee.
Bobby, what's going on?
Strangers find a dead man beaten and half naked in a parking lot on a gray July morning. Scattered around the body are a mix of German, Canadian, and U.S. currency, totaling about $4,000. The contents of his wallet identify him as 31-year-old Blair Adams of Surrey, British Columbia.
Every aspect of this case is mysterious. There's no logical explanation for anything he did. We can't say for a fact that this is why he did that, because there's no explanation for it.
We cannot come up with a motive for this man to be dead. We can't come up for a reasoning for him to be here. We can't come up for a reason for him to leave Canada. Nobody knew he was going to take this trip. Nobody. This is an actual whodunit.
No one knows why Blair left his home in British Columbia or how he ended up over 2,000 miles away
in Knoxville, Tennessee. His murder is one of the stranger cases we've ever come across. Was Blair running away from a killer, or was Blair just running away from himself? Before his mysterious death, Blair Adams was a foreman with a construction company in Surrey, British Columbia. Those who knew him say Blair liked his work, and he did it well.
Blair did seem to have a normal life. He had many friends. He had a job. He traveled on occasion. He had a history of several different girlfriends. Was well-liked by virtually everyone that we've had contact with.
But then something changed. Blair started having wild mood swings.
I asked him numerous times what was wrong, and he said, "I don't think I should tell you about it." And to this day, I don't know what it is.
On Friday, July 5th, Blair withdrew all his savings. He emptied his safety deposit box, more than $6,000 in cash and thousands in jewelry, gold, and platinum. On Sunday, Blair tried to enter the United States two different times.
Where are you going?
Seattle.
Can you step out of the car? I want to see some ID.
But he was refused entry because he was a young single guy carrying a lot of cash, the profile of a drug trafficker.
Just get back in the car and turn your vehicle around.
The next day, Blair showed up at his job, but he wasn't there to work.
I need to quit my job.
Why?
Need some time. Can I get my check?
That afternoon, he spent $1,600 on a round-trip airline ticket to Frankfurt, Germany. Just hours after buying the ticket, Blair showed up at a friend's home in a panic.
Blair.
I need you to take me to the border.
Take you to the border? It's the middle of the night. I can't leave my kids.
Okay, somebody's trying to kill me.
Blair seemed terrified, but his friend just couldn't help him out.
Okay, forget about it. Sorry to bother you.
Thanks anyway.
On Tuesday, instead of leaving for Germany, he turned in his tickets, rented a car, and headed back to the border. This time, Blair managed to slip through. He ended up in Seattle, where he dropped his rental car at the airport and bought a one-way ticket to Washington, D.C.
He paid about $770 for a one-way ticket when he could have purchased a round-trip ticket for approximately $350 or $400. So it would have been half the price for a round-trip ticket as he paid for a one-way ticket. It just seemed very unusual.
Blair arrived in D.C. early Wednesday morning and headed to Knoxville, more than 500 miles southwest.
His travel was unlogical in itself. I mean, why go to D.C. to turn around to come back to Knoxville? He had no reason to be in East Tennessee. He had no reason to be in Knoxville. Everything we can find out, he knows no one in East Tennessee or the eastern United States.
Hi, can you help me? I can't get my car started.
What's the problem?
Blair was first seen in Knoxville around 5:30 that afternoon.
Oh, this can't be your key.
Yeah, that's my key.
Well, this is a Nissan key.
Yeah?
Well, this is a Toyota.
So?
Well, it won't start it.
Well, that's the key I've been using.
You have another key?
No.
So the mechanic says, okay, empty out your pockets and let's look for it. He empties out all his pockets. There is no key to the Toyota.
Blair couldn't get a new key from the rental car company until the next morning. He was stranded in Knoxville. A mechanic drove him to a nearby hotel.
Best way to describe him would be paranoid, nervous, agitated, expecting someone to come in on him even though there wasn't anybody there. I don't know who he was looking for, but he was waiting for somebody to walk in for him.
Maybe Blair was being followed, or maybe he only thought so. The hotel's security camera shows that in the space of an hour, Blair went in and out of the lobby five times before finally paying for a room.
We can only assume that something was wrong with his thought process. He wasn't acting rationally.
After checking in, he walked out the front door. It was 7:37 p.m., the last time Blair Adams was known to be alive. 12 hours later, Blair's body was found in a parking lot about a half mile from his hotel. He was naked from the waist down. Blair's death was as strange as the last few days of his life.
His pants were removed in a way not like someone would take their own pants off, but in a way that someone else would remove your pants from you. His socks were turned inside out, his shoes were off, and his shirt was ripped open.
$4,000 in American, Canadian, and German currency was scattered around Blair's body. A small pack held another $2,000 worth of gold and jewelry. And strangely, the key to Blair's Toyota was laying about 10 feet from his body.
We start looking at the angle of maybe a drug deal gone bad. That didn't pan out. Robbery was immediately first thought of. You throw it away because all the money's still there. We tried to find anything in his background that would have led us to believe that he frequent with prostitutes or that he even had any homosexual experiences. Anything to explain how he was found the way he was found. We found nothing.
The autopsy stated that Blair sustained many cuts and abrasions. This would indicate that he was trying to defend himself from attack. Blair was ultimately killed by a violent blow that ruptured his stomach.
Kate, somebody's trying to kill me.
Although Blair believed that his life was in danger, authorities have another theory. They think that the threat was imaginary and Blair's journey was an escape from his own delusions. Either way, Blair Adams wound up dead, just as he had feared.
I want Blair back. I want him well and healthy. I want him to knock on the front door and come in. But obviously, that's not going to happen. I don't know. You know, Blair is dead. And it would be nice to have some understanding of why he died.
If you have any information about the murder of Blair Adams, please log on to our website at unsolved.com. Nassau County, New York. On a July night, a 20-year-old man named Ricardo Caputo makes a call to the police.
I want to report something very important.
Caputo has a girlfriend named Natalie Brown. He tells police to go to the home of her parents. Caputo had been dating Natalie for over a year and told authorities that they plan to marry.
I responded to the scene on Middle Neck Road. I went in the front door and immediately on my left I saw a kitchen, and in the kitchen was the body of Miss Brown. She had been stabbed repeatedly. The room was covered with blood. It was really a vicious assault on her. It was the worst I ever seen in my history. I've covered a lot of homicides in my life.
Natalie Brown's family and friends described her fiancé as likable and attractive. But in the case of Ricardo Caputo, appearances were more than deceiving. They were lethal. And Natalie wasn't his only victim. After Caputo was arrested for Natalie Brown's murder, a psychiatric review determined that Caputo was not competent to stand trial, so he was sent to New York's Matteawan State Hospital. At the maximum security facility, he met a 26-year-old psychologist named Judith Becker.
My doctor, my friend.
I believe it was a relationship of a psychologist and a patient. She felt that her patients were also her friends. She wanted them to trust her. And I think she felt they had to trust her in order to, for her to be able to help them. Okay.
Judith was charmed by Caputo, and over the next 2 years, he worked to gain her trust. Apparently, he succeeded.
Do you not like to remember?
And speaking to other inmates of Matteawan State Hospital,
Several of them stated that Ricardo Cupido had been bragging that he was going to use Judith Becker to gain his freedom from Mattawan State Hospital.
With her help, Cupido was transferred to a Manhattan psychiatric hospital that allowed patients to leave during the day. This gave Judith and Cupido more time to spend together outside the hospital walls. She even took him home to meet her family.
When we met Ricardo, she introduced him as a fellow who worked with her at Mattawan. She continued the relationship as a friend and as a psychologist and as somebody he could turn to. And I don't believe that she knew she was in as much danger as she ultimately was.
One October day, Judith didn't show up for a family boating trip. Concerned, her parents went to her apartment.
Judy?
When they entered the apartment where she lived, there was dinner for two on the coffee table in the living room.
Judy?
And when they walked into the bedroom, they found their daughter lying on her back in bed, wearing only a half slip. She had been brutally beaten about the head and strangled with one of her stockings.
Cupido had disappeared with Judith's car, checkbook, and some of her clothing. Five months later, in San Francisco, Ricardo Cupido met Barbara Taylor, a book editor. These photos of Barbara were taken on the trip to Yosemite. She was later found beaten to death in her apartment. Caputo's fingerprints were at the crime scene, but he had vanished again. El Paso, Texas. 5 days after Barbara's body was found, a man calling himself Ricardo Diaz was held by the U.S. immigration officials.
He was turned over to the custody of U.S. officials, and he was incarcerated at the Alien Detention Facility, which is located here in El Paso, Texas.
Like the other detainees, Diaz was fingerprinted. He knew that it would not take long for his real identity to be uncovered, because Diaz was, in reality, Ricardo Cupido.
You have asked.
Sure do.
3 days later, Cupido and three other prisoners took a guard hostage using kitchen knives as weapons. The men escaped the compound and crossed the border to Mexico in a stolen car. All were recaptured except for Cupido. The escapees told police that he was headed to Mexico City.
There he moved in with a young 21-year-old college student by the name of Laura Marie Gomez.
2 years later, Laura was found dead in her Mexico City apartment.
Ms. Gomez was found brutally beaten, stomped to death. She had been tortured prior to her death.
Laura was 2.5 months pregnant. Police believe the father and the killer was Ricardo Cupido.
Since he's done this all over the United States and in Mexico, we have to consider him a serial killer.
Six years later and 2,000 miles away, he may have struck again. 60-year-old Jackie Bernard, a prominent author and social activist, was found murdered in her Manhattan apartment. A private investigator hired by Jackie's family received a tip identifying Cupido as Jackie's killer.
The caller also said that Cupido boasted about killing several other women and also some men.
Update. After nearly two decades on the run, Ricardo Cupido turned himself into police in New York City. He said that he decided to surrender after his victims began appearing in his nightmares and that he was afraid that he would kill again. While a fugitive, he traveled throughout North and South America, married twice and fathered six children. Ricardo Caputo pleaded guilty to two murders and was sentenced to 25 years to life. 3 years later, he died of a heart attack while playing basketball in Attica prison. He was 48 years old. Next, a man and his family have searched for a treasure for over 50 years. Was it stolen by the U.S. military? In 1937, a man named Doc Noss claimed that he found an incredible treasure deep inside Victoria Peak in southern New Mexico. He reported seeing more than 100 tons of gold bars stacked like firewood. Doc and his wife, Babe, filed a mining claim. They hired an expert to widen the tunnel, but the blast caused the mine shaft to cave in. By the time he died in 1949, Doc Noss had not gotten any closer to his treasure. For 2 years, Babe tried to dig through the rubble and reach the gold, but she too was unsuccessful. And then, in 1951, the Army established a missile range at White Sands, New Mexico. They annexed Victoria Peak and forced Babe to stop her digging. During the late 1950s, two airmen claimed that they had actually entered the mountain and seen the gold bars. But they said that the military would not allow them to go back and remove them. In 1961, Babe accused the military of digging for the gold themselves. The Army officially denied her accusations.
She was protesting vehemently that the Army would be excavating on her claim while they were denying her access to do the same thing.
Finally, the Army did allow Babe, one of the airmen, and their team to excavate the peak. But the military placed a 2-week time limit on the dig, and Babe found no gold.
If the mountain has not been penetrated and materials removed from this mountain, this will be the biggest thing that this country's ever seen.
Update.
After our broadcast, two viewers contacted us with new information about the disputed treasure on Victoria's Peak.
It's kind of hot out here.
The first call came from Gene and Juanita Irwin, a retired couple living in Baytown, Texas. Juanita Irwin's brother, Captain Orby Swanner, had been stationed at the White Sands Missile Range in the early 1960s. Swanner told his family an extraordinary story.
He started to tell the story of the treasure that was found at White Sands Missile Range. Now, Captain Swanner went out to inspect and confirm. And sure enough, it was true. And the Pentagon sent down a special team, which included my brother-in-law, Captain Swanner. There were several chambers in the cave, and it had an immense amount of stuff in it. And they photographed it. And he said it was in excess of $300 million. I asked him what they did with the gold once they removed it. And he said he thought they took it to Fort Knox.
We confirm that Captain Swanner served as an officer assigned to security at White Sands Missile Range in 1961. But the U.S. Army denies any knowledge of the treasure.
I know nothing, I've seen nothing of any such claim in the records that I've seen.
Russell Dunn, the second person who called our phone center, was a friend of Captain Swanner. Dunn says that Swanner told him the same story.
He further told me that there was a government agency, and as I recall, he mentioned Secret Service, did remove the gold. It was in bars, and it was taken away in trucks. I believe he was honestly telling me the truth.
there is still more evidence that the military took gold from Victoria Peak. Judge H.L. Moorman, who knew Babe, stated in a 1961 affidavit that he and three friends had actually seen soldiers at work on the peak. Moorman claimed that he saw military equipment and beams that could be used to support underground tunnels.
Well, it was the military conducting that operation out there, and of course they had access to the equipment, they had access to the location, and they were out there doing the same thing we were doing. They were looking for the gold.
Moorman testified that his group talked to Captain Swanner, who ordered them to leave the area. When Moorman reported the activity to Babe Noss, she called the New Mexico State Land Office. They contacted a Colonel Jaffe at the missile range.
Called the name of Jaffe, a Colonel Jaffe. And I asked him, I said, is there somebody in there digging? I said, they shouldn't be doing that. And he said, no, there is no digging on that peak. And he said, if there are, it's none of your damn business.
Jordan says that within 24 hours, he received a call from Major General John R. Schenkel, the commander at White Sands. Schenkel admitted that there had been digging on the peak, but said that it would stop immediately. The military withdrew. Soon after, Moorman and his friends returned to Victoria Peak. They found roads, scaffolds, and tunnels, but no sign of Babe's gold fortune.
They exploded her claim, and I think maybe the money has gone away. I think it's gone. I think the soldiers may have moved it out.
There was absolutely no foundation to the charge that gold was being removed, and there was absolutely no evidence that gold had ever been removed.
One of the few eyewitnesses who claimed to have actually seen the gold was Captain Orby Swanner, the former head of security at White Sands. But is there any physical evidence that Swanner was inside Victoria Peak in 1961? During the 1977 expedition, Babe Noss and the other excavators found Orby Swanner's evidence.
They went in and found some military debris, battery packs and such, and they photographed on the wall of one of the deeper tunnels a name and a date and an Army serial number on the wall. The name was Captain Orby Swanner. The date was October 1961. I don't feel that the Department of the Army in the 60s treated my grandmother fairly. They really tried to make a fool out of her, and all the time she was telling the truth. They had sent my grandmother on a wild goose chase for decades. If that is the fact, I think a great injustice has been done.
Next, a killer who used bombs to murder innocent civilians is finally brought to justice. And later, an accused drug lord concocts a daring escape, dressed in a wig, women's clothing, and makeup. Previously, we profiled the case of Eric Robert Rudolph, known as the infamous Olympic Park bomber. Rudolph's first attack was in Atlanta's Centennial Park during the 1996 Summer Olympics.
Let's see that pretty smile of yours. One, two, three.
'44-year-old Alice Hawthorne was killed, and over 100 more were injured. Ah! 6 months later, a similar type of bomb was detonated at an abortion clinic in suburban Atlanta. And a month after that, a Midtown Atlanta gay and lesbian nightclub was targeted.
We're building a good prosecutable court case based upon the forensic evidence we had where we could tie the bombs together, but we still didn't know the identity of the bomber. We didn't know who he was.
Police began receiving letters from the so-called Army of God, claiming responsibility for at least two of the bombings.
Those who participate in any way in the murder of children may be targeted for attack. We will target sodomites, their organizations, and all those who push their agenda. We will target all facilities and personnel of the federal government.
Birmingham, Alabama, 11 months after the third Atlanta bombing. Outside a woman's health and abortion clinic, an overturned flower pot caught the eye of Robert Sanderson. An off-duty police officer, Sanderson was working that day as a security guard. Sanderson was killed instantly. Emily Lyons, the clinic's head nurse, lost her left eye when she was riddled with shrapnel. Just after the explosion, a witness saw a man remove a wig and throw it away as he left the scene. He was able to give the police the man's license plate number. The truck was traced to Eric Rudolph. When an FBI SWAT team raided his trailer in Murphy, North Carolina, they missed him by only minutes. However, authorities weren't sure whether or not Rudolph had actually left the area. Update. 5 years after Eric Rudolph was last seen, a police officer noticed what he thought was a homeless man. He was rummaging through the trash behind a market in Murphy, North Carolina. The officer took the man to the police station and noticed the resemblance to the wanted poster for Eric Rudolph. He made the arrest on the spot. During his time on the run, Rudolph had survived by eating wildlife in the Appalachian wilderness and foraging in dumpsters in the surrounding towns. Rudolph agreed to plead guilty to all the bombings in exchange for being spared the death penalty. He was sentenced to 4 consecutive life terms and will spend the rest of his life behind bars. From the age of 17, Lionel Luviano made enough money to enjoy the life of a wealthy playboy. How did he do this? By being one of the biggest drug traffickers in the southern U.S. But when he was just 21, the police brought his lavish lifestyle to a sudden end.
After a 6-month sting operation, Lionel Luviano, only 21 years old, was arrested in Houston, Texas. Despite his young age, he was a key figure in an international drug ring that reportedly moved nearly $250,000 in heroin every month.
Lionel Luviano led a very extravagant lifestyle when he was free in the Houston area. He's 21 years old and had all the luxuries of an extremely extravagant individual.
Before his arrest, Luviano was involved in a serious motorcycle accident. While he awaited trial, authorities had no choice but to allow him to continue his treatment at a local hospital. He was shackled to his bed 24 hours a day in a room that he shared with a total stranger, Vasquez Martinez. A week after Luviano was admitted, some visitors arrived unannounced.
Three individuals, two women and a man, walked into LBJ Hospital, did not have to go through any security measures as this is not an institution, walked up to the third floor, Lionel Luviano's room.
We're here to see our friend Vasquez Martinez, please.
Yes.
They indicated they were going to visit the individual across the bed from Lionel Luviano. The guard was in a position to see them walk over to the other individual's bed. So he felt comfortable in the fact, as would anybody, that they were just visiting the individual across the bed, who was not a prisoner, and he was able to have visitors at any time of the day.
Hey, Vasquez, we got some business to take care of.
Shh.
In reality, the visitors were one of Luviano's sisters and two other family members.
What's going on?
Shut up. Never mind.
Believing they were armed, Vasquez watched in disbelief as Lionel began a total makeover. A shave, a full-cut, two-piece woman's suit, and then a wig and some makeup, and the transformation was complete.
Martin, how do I look?
All right, man.
You look okay?
Yeah.
So you look great. What about the hair?
Come on. Yeah.
Okay, Vamos.
You go down.
Lionel Luviano escaped masquerading as his own sister.
See ya.
The guard outside of the hospital room was not surprised when he saw two women and a man leave the room. That's what he'd observed walk into the room.
Luviano's sister stayed behind. With a concealed gun, she kept Vasquez from sounding the alarm. She would later slip away during the confusion following the discovery of Luviano's escape. Luviano's accomplices were later captured, but the drug lord is still at large.
Lionel Luviano was looking at approximately 20 years in prison. Being that it being a federal prison, he would approximately do 19 of those years. There's very little good time given in such like this, so I'm sure that this played quite heavily on his mind, his desire to escape.
Lionel Luviano stands 5 feet 5 inches tall and weighs 120 pounds. Authorities believe that he may be living in Mexico. He should be considered armed and dangerous. If you have any information, please log on to our website at unsolved.com.